nearby Borrego Springs was designated as California's first dark sky community in 2009. Julian has recently joined the club. Then there's Joshua Tree National Park, an official dark sky park not far from Palm Springs in vicinity. Head for the Sky's the Limit Observatory in 29 Palms, just beyond Joshua Tree's north entrance in the fall for the area's annual Big Sky Party. Tickets sell out, so get yours early. Otherwise, go east for the darkest skies. Another don't-miss desert stargazing destination is already famous Death Valley National Park, a gold-tier dark sky park, the highest possible dark sky rating. The park is so huge, the opportunities for solo and small group reveries seem endless. Death Valley's official Starfest comes in February and includes a stellar scientific lineup. Folks from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and Ames Research Center, as well as the SETI Institute and California Institute of Technology. Visit the Panamint Valley just outside Death Valley National Park for a variety of dark sky events, from the Great Orion Dark Sky Festival in mid-March and Death Valley Star Camp from early February well into April, to October's California Dark Sky Festival, 3 nights of dark skies, professional astronomy talks, and night photography, all offered by the Eastern Sierra Observatory. Camp on site in star pods or BYO camping gear. Another dark sky possibility not far away is the BLM's Alabama Hills National Scenic Area west of Lone Pine. Until next time, star partiers, this is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Knockout Collision Repair, Chico's high-tech auto body shop specializing in complete collision repair and restoration. Knockout Collision works on all makes and models and always provides complimentary consultations. Appointments or information at 899-9202. And at knockoutcollisionrepair.com, Chico's fast and fair collision repair. And we're made possible by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering organic and local produce, organic groceries, supplements, as well as hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, cold brew, coffee, and more. The co-op accepts online orders for curbside pickup and is looking for co-op owners to serve on its board of directors. For details, visit chiconaturalfoods.coop/BOD. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main. Tonight on Ecotopia, we'll be talking with Andrew Boyd, author of a book called I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Andrew's book doesn't mince words. Catastrophe is coming, though we don't know what form it will take. He consulted with important thinkers and collected a variety of opinions on both what the catastrophe will be and how people can respond to it, from defeatism to measured optimism. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Andrew Boyd, who wants a better catastrophe.
And we'll play a little catastrophe music for you. This is Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain.
is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and Andrew Boyd is with us this afternoon. He is a writer, activist, humorist, and CEO, Chief Existential Officer of the Climate Clock, a global campaign that blends art, science, grassroots organizing to get the world to act in time. He also created the grief storytelling ritual, the Climate Ribbon, which allows people to express their feelings about climate chaos.
The book we'll be discussing today has a title and subtitles worth absorbing. I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. It's an existential manual for tragic optimists, can-do pessimists, and compassionate doomers. Welcome, Andrew Boyd.
Yes, I'm so glad to be here, Stephen and Susan. It's a pleasure.
Thank
pleasure.
You.
Looking forward to the conversation.
So am I. You've been an activist since your student days at the University of Michigan, often using satire and drama to bring attention to your causes. Could you give us a little bit of, tell us a little about your background?
Sure, yeah. I grew up in New York City. My father's from the Midwest. His father was a Presbyterian minister, so some values came down in that way, but my father is a scientist and rejected the faith, and my mom's parents came over from Romania. Romanian Jews settled in Brooklyn, and so I was a bit of a mix, a very American mutt.
Yeah.
And picked up various values. One of them was the Jewish tradition, the Jewish sort of moral commandment, basically that you, it's not on you to save the world, but it is on you to try. So that's sort of, if you will, been a through line, that's seen me through decades of activism and led to this book. I became, a student organizer out at the University of Michigan. And the issue at that time was trying to prevent the world from, there was a Cold War and an arms race raging, mm-hmm. and trying to pull both the Soviet Union and the U.S. back from the brink by, protesting against the technological advances in nuclear weapons that were making things more more fragile, more threatening. So that was we created and I had a lot of friends who were activists and a lot of friends who were artists, but they weren't quite mm-hmm. talking to each other. So I was like, brought them together, and that's the alchemy of helping the artist to be more, effective, and helping the, impactful, and helping the activist to be more creative has been my, my métier, if you will,
nice.
Sort of ever since, of all kinds of campaigns.
So you're, Andrew, the chief existential officer of something called the Climate Clock. It's on the web at climateclock.world, and we've got it up on our monitor today, and we're going to read from it as the program progresses.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about it. What does the Climate Clock measure?
Yeah, well, climate change is not something, a problem that we can solve later. It's a problem we need to solve now. It's got a very strict timeline. We are currently pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and they are having an effect, and we must reduce, bend that emission curve within a certain period of time to avoid crossing critical red lines that scientists have told us not to, foremost among them, not warming the planet any more than 1.5 degrees centigrade. So it has a timeline. We need to do certain things within a certain time. So the clock tracks that. Basically, we need to transition off of fossil fuels to a renewable, solar, wind, geothermal, et cetera, powered economy, ideally within this decade, what they call the critical decade. And so the clock counts that window of hope, that window for taking action down, while it counts up the percentage of the world's energy that is coming from renewable sources. Currently, the clock reads about six and a half years, and we are at 13.5% of the world's energy coming from renewables. It's going in the right direction, but not fast enough. Our job is to accelerate that, get us off of fossil fuels and onto renewables. In that time frame, the clock tracks our progress on that critical solution.
In fact, at this moment, the clock reads 6 years, 129 days, 15 hours, 48 minutes, and it's counting down 12, 11, 10 seconds. A thing interesting, too, about your climate clock, you have a number of statistics that run beneath it. Right now it's showing land protected by indigenous people, loss and damage owed by the G20 nations, the amount of money that's a much smaller figure prepared to go to help those nations.
That's right. Yeah. So the framework we use is one deadline, many lifelines. Right. So we have a time frame we need to act within, but there are many important solution pathways. You just named several of them. Just last week, we added one more on International Women's Day. We added a gender parity lifeline that is tracking the percentage of the world's parliaments composed of women, and it's been proven in study after study that the more, and that's currently at 26.5%, and but we should by right have it at 50%, and it's a climate solution because many studies have shown that the more women are in decision making power, the more we are addressing climate, the more adaptable our societies become, the more serious we take that issue, and the more concerted effort we enact around that. So we just added that last week on International Women's Day, and I was at the UN for that moment. It was very exciting.
That's great. Yeah, that's really neat. So on Ecotopia, we have often lamented that we wind up bringing listeners a lot of bad news, and your title and the book itself suggests that we can have a chuckle or two on our way to the inevitable Armageddon. Is the end of life as we know it got humor possibilities, or is it, it feels humorless to me?
Absolutely, no. I mean, arguably climate change and the impacts that it's going to have, you could say, is the least of a joke, you know, the least joke-like thing that humans may ever experience. But humor, gallows humor, when times are tough, is a coping mechanism for many of us, for me certainly. It is almost, you know, when times are really tough, it's, you know, arguably an existential survival strategy. We can't, if we can laugh, then we can, there's distance, you know, there's a bit of daylight between our circumstances and our victimhood. You know, if we can laugh, it's a kind of hope. It's a kind of defiance. It's a, you know, it's a way to claim a little agency, you know, and power in a situation that often feels just doom-filled and powerless. And it helps us handle the truth, you know. It helps us, as I think we all know that in our bodies, you know, instinctively, that humor brings us together. Humor leavens the burdens we have to carry. Humor helps us see the truth, you know, without dying of it, you know. So it's absolutely essential in the book. On a good day, on a good day, I'm funny, and you know, and a good day, someone reading the book will laugh, and it will be the news will not be as feel so terrible because of that. You know,
there is some gallows humor spread throughout there, but we're going to ask you to tell a couple jokes at the end of the show. But let's first move through some of the gloomier stuff. You wrote, and I want to read it. Early in the book, you say, "I don't want to encourage premature despair with talk of doom, but I also don't want to BS myself or anyone else with false hopes. Of course, we have to do everything we can," says my natural enthusiasm and fighting spirit. "But why bother doing anything?" says my rational tabulation of data. So where does a better catastrophe fit into those kind of conflicting viewpoints?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, like you've pointed out here, we're living with a contradiction. You know, we're living with in an impossible situation, in a situation where the facts are really brutal, are, you know, telling us pretty terrible things about our future. Yet we are hope machines. You know, we want things to be better. We will do all that we can to survive, you know, as a species, as a society, as a community. And so we're holding these, you know, this this contradiction, and we refuse to give up hope. You know, and I dig in with yes, we passed certain thresholds, we've missed certain targets, we're in for decades, a century of trouble, and so we can't pretend that we're not in for some kind of catastrophe. And so then the question is, let's not pretend that. Let's not decide it's all over, right? Let's not fall into doom or despair, but let's also not pretend that things are better than they are. So what's that middle path? It's like, how can we get the best catastrophe that is still left to us, you know, that is still in the cards? And it's possibly, I know, oxymoronically and ironically maybe, but it is possibly the most important thing humans will ever do is to get the least bad case scenario in this century. It could be the difference between extinction and surviving in a more sort of humbled, sustainable, in better balance with the earth kind of way. So it's critical. The better catastrophe sort of summarizes our mission, if you will, our goal as a civilization.
So in your quest for a better catastrophe, you interviewed a number of well-known people. Let's start with Guy McPherson. We interviewed him on Ecotopia, and he told us on Ecotopia, it's over. Just be nice to one another as the world ends. Just be kind. You know, don't do the dog-eat-dog thing. What did you learn from him? Every time I talk about this topic or read about it, I'm curious about what catastrophe looks like, what people are anticipating. Is it because we've also interviewed Orloff, what's his first name?
Dmitry Orloff. The five stages of collapse.
And, you know, that it could be economic, it could be political, it will be. I mean, all of those catastrophes will happen. But what's a lesser catastrophe and what's a greater catastrophe?
Well, there's a couple questions in there. So I just
there's wanted, several.
It's fascinating that, you know, I love the title of your show, Ecotopia, but then it's very interesting that you're interviewing, you know, all the doomers and all the catastrophes, you know? Yeah. So that's just worth noting. So Guy McPherson was a very, you know, he's... Still hear me?
Yep. Yes. Gotcha.
Yep. Okay, I lost the audio for once. Sorry. There we go. We're back.
Yes, good.
So Guy McPherson's a very, you know, compelling personality, very learned, decades being a scientist till he sort of stepped away from the profession. Interesting person to interview. I do not agree with his prognostication. I do not think we're in for near-term human extinction. Mm-hmm. He is an outlier in the scientific, fairly extreme outlier in the scientific community. I was actually having dinner with somebody last night, a oceanographer scientist, and was saying he thought it was almost irresponsible of me to put him in the book. He's not really operating within the scientific community anymore, not operating in a peer-reviewed way, though obviously he wrote many, many peer-reviewed papers in the past. So it's worth just putting an asterisk there on his recent work. I found him a very lovely person to just converse with in spite of his gloomy, his very harsh predictions. But what I learned from him was that even in the very worst case scenario, even in the worst, where we're headed for, human extinction in the next three generations, as he once used to predict, now he doesn't put a timeline on it, even then there is a moral approach. Even then there is a better and a worse way to go.
Yes.
With kindness, compassion, solidarity, taking care of the least vulnerable. As he says it, if the train is falling off the cliff, well, don't brace your fall with the next person, don't use them as a cushion, you have to operate ethically even in these extreme circumstances. So that it was a lesson that even the most science-oriented person could have a spiritual approach, and even in the worst case scenario there is a way to treat one another well. So to in a sense snatch a little utopia from the total dystopia. Mm-hmm. So that was a lesson from talking to him. You've talked to many of these people who lay out various ways this will unfold and scenarios. It hasn't generally, a combination of hitting ecological limits that then have an economic consequences. And so we may not experience, we'll experience the extreme weather, et cetera, but there'll be certain, food costs will rise due to agriculture in certain regions of the world becoming expensive or impossible. So we won't necessarily experience those climatic shifts directly because they're somewhere else, but we will experience them economically. So it's a very complex mix of things. And of course, there will be, a lot of it depends how it unfolds. A lot of it depends on the fabric of society and how we respond, say, to more and more climate refugees. Are we going to block our borders and refuse to let them in and refuse to take responsibility in the global north that we caused? We burned all this coal and oil for 200 years that heated up the planet, that caused people to lose their coastlines and lose their cropland, and then sort of let them, and take no responsibility? Or are we going to accept that responsibility and figure out a way to get through this together? So a lot of it depends on our moral response and on whether we center justice in the solutions and in the crisis management that we bring as things happen in all the various ways and sectors. So trying to answer your multiple questions there, hope I did an okay job.
You interviewed a number of people as part of the book, and you talk about your own journey, how your thoughts were changing, but then you talked with people like Meg Wheatley, a Buddhist, eco-philosopher Joanna Macy, and others. I wonder if you could talk about a few of those people, and we're using McPherson as a benchmark here, the most extreme position, and everybody else in the book is a lot more optimistic than McPherson. I wonder if you could share your thoughts on some of those folks and what they meant to you as you wrote.
Absolutely, and it was an extraordinary honor to meet with these people, and it was a little bit, or a lot in some ways, transformative for me, and in terms of my perspective and in terms of my own ability to stay grounded amidst the unfolding impossible news, of that the climate scientists are bringing us. So, and I chose a wide diversity of people as well. So. One person from your home state of California, based in Oakland, Gopal Dayaneni, who's been teaching and theorizing and developing strategic frameworks for how this will unfold and how we can center justice and how we communities can be empowered to craft their own solutions. And not just receive the crumbs of what government or corporations decide is the way to handle this. So he in a way, I think a summary of his take, if you will, was acknowledging that things are, we're in for trouble. So he was saying, we're going to suffer. So let's distribute that suffering equitably. Now, that just seemed like two-handed approach that we've been talking about. Adrienne Marie Brown, who's wears many hats. She's a doula and a body worker healer. She's a strong proponent of what the science of a justice-oriented science fiction, what she calls visionary fiction, and a community organizer and what she calls an organizational healer. A fascinating person. Has written a number of books that are gaining renown.
I was going to say we were impressed with her work. Also, we spent time at Michigan State up the road from you, and so we know Detroit. And so she's already experienced urban collapse. I mean, Detroit, past 50 years, has fallen apart as a city, although it's rebounding some. But it's an example of what a major city can look like when catastrophe comes.
Right, and that was not so much an ecological catastrophe as a social. Economic and a social catastrophe.
Yes.
And she's located herself there and is doing incredible work at the community level. And one of her takeaways, you know, was, look, we're in for a hard fall. So how can we fall as if we were, you know, holding a child on our chest, mm-hmm. you know, and angling ourselves so that we're falling onto our backs, but protecting the child. And, you know, that was one of the most beautiful things I heard in all of these interviews, like as a way to imagine how to protect the most vulnerable as we all go through, you know, this very difficult unraveling that many predict is to come. So those are some of the sensibilities that I walk, you know, that were takeaway signal, takeaway wisdom for me, and that I folded into the book to share with everyone else. I could go on, but how's that for some example?
That gets us.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I always do this. I get us off,
we're off
the rails.
Script. We're off script.
Yeah, we're off. Here I go. You know, I think about you're talking about the need and the sensibilities that talk about care and compassion and protection of the most weak and the most vulnerable. And I look back at just in my own lifetime, how people have treated, I think about famines, various famines in Africa, and how kind of minimal the response was to that when there was tons of food available and it didn't get there. They couldn't, it either wasn't a priority or they couldn't figure it out. I haven't seen in my lifetime. Well, that's I'm exaggerating because I'm in the doom mindset right now. The kind of compassion that's going to be needed by both nations, by the political leaders, and by individuals that can mitigate the awful impact, particularly on poor people and the most vulnerable. So what do we have to do to nurture that?
Well, I think it's important just to note that I think we've been fed a bit of a lie about humans and about how we operate in crisis, that we are just looking after ourselves or our immediate, you know, family, and, you know, to hell with everyone else kind of thing. But there's a lots of evidence, you know, most sort of beautifully you know, recounted in, you know, Rebecca Solnit's, I don't know if mm-hmm. you've had her on the show, but Rebecca Solnit's investigation into how people respond in crisis and disasters, mm-hmm. a paradise built in hell. You know, I think the extraordinary communities that arise in disaster, she just recounts in situation after situation, the Mexico City earthquake, etc., that people are actually come to each other's aid and, it's very deep in our wiring. And Gopal, one of the people I interviewed, I mentioned, would say this again and again. We are wired for reciprocity. We are wired for survival. We are wired for collective responses to these situations. And, that doesn't mean that there aren't also ugly things that happen. But it's just worth, like, not accepting the dominant narrative that we all, you know, that it all falls apart and we all just mm-hmm. don't take care of each other in those moments of extremis. But yeah, I would say, to answer the question about there's so many things to be done so that less privileged people, communities of color, poorer people are not always bearing the brunt of the ecological disasters or the location of the toxic plants that, you know, rich, you know, the upper middle class folks don't want in their neighborhood.
Right.
And so, you know, that's where environmental justice, climate justice comes in. And so some basic things is, you know, just if the economy was more equal, people yeah. would have more social power and to more resources to respond.
Right.
That's one thing. If there wasn't the kind of toxic, you know, the sort of environmental justice redlining, like in Cancer Alley in Louisiana, Texas, then mm-hmm. The poorer and more racially mistreated people wouldn't always, you know, wouldn't be poisoned. I think it's about five times more impacted by local pollution than others. So that's, you know, a more equal tax system could actually make for more climate justice,
yes.
Right? You know, it's like mm-hmm. these things are all connected. So those yeah. are some quick thoughts. But the last, just to end with, there's a notion that's very a central notion in the climate justice movement for those who are on the front lines, those who are most impacted. Nothing about us without us. And so right. it's like we're the most impacted. So we have special knowledge, information, experience about the solutions that would address those impacts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, if you're going to craft solutions, we should be at that table. In fact, by historical rights, we might want to have a somewhat larger say since we are the most impacted and we have been the most overlooked historically. So nothing about us without us is a very good principle to answer, you know, to guide responses, disaster responses, and also just the crafting of solutions as we hit these difficult moments.
I'm back on track again, and so that was very helpful.
Okay,
you and others have created a storytelling project that allows people to express their feelings about the coming catastrophe. Mm-hmm. It's called the Climate Ribbon. Could you mm-hmm. talk about it and how it works
yeah.
and what its purpose is and
yeah.
what kind of response you've gotten?
Yeah, this has been a project that's been existing for about 10 years.
Yes.
Started in New York City for the big People's Climate March. That was the largest climate march in the history so far. 400,000 people in New York, you know, the just in prior to the Paris Agreement, you know, trying mm-hmm. to show popular support for a global climate treaty, and which we got a bit later. So it helped to put fire under Obama's, you know, to move things forward. So it's based on a basic principle of Americans don't like to deal with grief, right? We try to avoid grief. It's part of how we roll as a culture. It's also something that gets in the way of action, right? If we're feeling the grief vaguely, but we're not letting ourselves really step into it and go through the process,
right.
Then we're blocking our ability to act. So the thinking was, how do we create a ritual, a story-sharing ritual, where we can together come together and acknowledge all the things that we're, you know, that we are potentially or already have or about to lose, and how we feel about it, and do that collectively so it's safe and moves us forward as opposed to moves us back into our corners, and then we can move from our climate grief to climate action, ideally. So the central question there was, what do you love too much to lose? And people would find something concrete, something not just a vague general thing, but something very concrete in their life that they loved, that was under threat, that they didn't want to lose. Somebody from Southern Florida said Miami, my city. Mm-hmm. Somebody from Macedonia, because this was a global thing. We mm-hmm. took it to Paris and to all over the world. Said that the tree I planted in my grandmother's backyard when I was 4 years old. You know, mm-hmm. That for them was sort of where they would plant their flag, what they would be, what mattered to them enough to be willing to open their hearts to our and see the clear-eyed truth of our situation and do something about it. For me, it was the kindness among strangers. You know, that to me was so essential to what it means to be human and what keeps a society and a community together. And like speaking to your previous point, like worried that that could come apart under extreme stress of weather and refugee, you know, climate, the millions of climate refugees that are predicted, et cetera. This 1 8-year-old in the Rockaways, one of the worst hit regions of New York City during Hurricane Sandy, who'd almost lost everything, when we did the workshop with them, they said, this 8-year-old kid said, my books, my toys, my apartment, my friend, my mom. He'd almost lost all of that, and he didn't want to lose that again. So it was like that, and then everyone exchanged these stories, and if you found something that really moved you, and we wrote them on ribbons and exchanged them, and if you found a ribbon and a message like that that moved you, you would remove it from the big assembly of these ribbons that were hanging on a big tree or on a an altar in a church, and tie it to your wrist and become the guardian and the protector of what that other person most mattered to them. And so that we created a powerful solidarity, what we called an intimate solidarity among strangers. And you saw all that was, you know, when it was all assembled that way and connected that way, you could see all that was that we stood to lose, but all the love and mutual protection that was also in the mix. And so it was very powerful and inspiring, and it allowed people to move from through their climate grief to climate action. And we often ask the follow-up question is, okay, that's what you love too much to lose. Now, what are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. That was a sort of follow-up. Yeah, so that was the climate ribbon. It's still online at theclimateribbon.org. And you can still participate in that ritual and see all the amazing photos of these trees hung with all these ribbons from all over the world, and et cetera. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 FM, community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And we're talking with Andrew Boyd about his book, I Want a Better Climate Catastrophe. It's published by one of our favorite publishers. They're holding the line, New Society. It's a book that acknowledges that our world is in deep existential trouble, but also takes a balanced look at many variables, provides support. And there are three groups you mentioned, tragic optimists, can-do pessimists, and compassionate doomers. And then at the end of the book, you say you're in all three groups. So maybe you could tell us, again, tragic optimists, can-do pessimists, and compassionate doomers. Who fits into those various groups?
Yeah, well, I'm on a book tour, and I'm seven events in and coming to California soon. I mentioned these three categories and sort of take a show of hands and... We get a lot in every category, and some people are raising their hands more than once, and I raise my hand all three times, as you mentioned. So, we can't be simple optimists because, you know, the circumstances are, you know, we already know we're in for a lot of trouble. So we can't, it's not in good faith to be a simple, hyper-enthusiastic optimist, and it's fairly useless to be just a hardcore pessimist. And so what is an engaged version, an honest optimist, is a tragic optimist, and an engaged pessimist is a can-do pessimist. So the way I think about it is, a tragic optimist, sets their sights on the goal that is necessary, yet impossible. Unfortunately, a lot of our goals are necessary, yet impossible, and gives it his or her all, hoping that the impossible somehow becomes possible before it's too late. And we're thinking that, after all, there's nothing more inspiring than a smart, dedicated, reality-based person acting as if the impossible were possible to actually make it so, right? So that's the sort of, tragic optimist. And then on the other hand, the can-do pessimist sets their sights on the most ambitious goal that they think they can pull off, even if they know it is insufficient to the task, right? That's the other flip side that, like passing the Inflation Reduction Act, $350 billion for climate. Yes, it's utterly, it's a lot of money, but it's totally insufficient to the civilizational level crisis that we're in. And yet, it's the first meaningful piece of climate legislation the Senate has passed in 36 years. So, right? Like, I'm going to note that it's insufficient, but I'm going to take that and try to shift some things. So, can-do pessimists trust that in the unlikely event, noting that they're a pessimist, right, of achieving, that small goal that is insufficient, that we might create the condition for a more ambitious goal that maybe after a few of those iterations is up to the task. So that's the can-do pessimist. And then the compassionate, doomer or compassionate nihilist, to be a little more philosophically language about it, is, doesn't believe that either of those other paths are worthwhile, that those people are, even if they're, pessimist or more humbled optimist, doesn't even, trust that any of that is worthwhile, still recognizes the beauty and humanity in the people who are striving in those two ways, and tries to pitch in and help. And basically realizing that, you know, you don't actually have to believe in anything to give a word, give a S word. I'm not allowed to say on the radio here. But, you know, that's also a funny little contradiction. And so there's a lot of people I meet who are, no, it's all over, whatever. But they're trying to do good things. You know, they're trying to help. Even joining social movements to help those people who still believe and have a strategy and are moving forward. So those are sort of three of the modalities. And I'd encourage anyone out there who feels camaraderie with any, or, you know, that feels that that's, that they could find a home in one of those three or more ways to get involved. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of exciting climate action going on at all levels, community level and state level, et cetera. So, yeah. You have three choices of how.
The climate clock has gone down by about 25 minutes while we're talking. It's 6 years, 129 days, 15 hours, 17 minutes, counting down at about 17 seconds. What happens if the climate clock hits zero, especially to those groups of optimists and pessimists and doomers?
Right. Well, that's a good question. It's a question that comes up often. It is not a doomsday clock. It is not like when we hit zero, you know, it's all over, the lights go out. There's nothing like that. As I said earlier, the clock is tracking our window of hope, our critical time frame in which to take action to get certain things done. And justice demands that we meet those goals, but we will probably fall short. Science says it would be very ill-advised to not meet them, but, you know, we didn't do the things we needed to do decades ago. So we probably won't meet it. We won't get that bottom number that we mentioned of the percentage of the world's energy coming from renewables to 100% before the top number that you said is about 6.5 years gets to zero. That's what we should do, but we probably won't. You know, there could be a extraordinary synergy of circumstance, of government action, of, you know, popular uprising, of, you know, technological breakthroughs, et cetera, where we could get closer than many prognosticators say, but we'll probably, that top number will hit zero before the bottom number gets to the 100% that we want. And so at that point, we acknowledge that we missed our first and most important goal, but that we haven't missed other very important goals. Mm-hmm. So we say, okay, we're in for more than 1.5 degrees warming. That is not good, but it is survivable. Let us set our sights on the next goal. That could be 2 degrees warming. We want to definitely stay below 2 degrees. And then we reset the clock to set that new goal. And then we give that mission our all.
So that sounds like the tragic optimist talking.
I think both the tragic optimist and the can-do pessimist on board with that. But no, fair point. Yeah.
I was drawing a Venn diagram of those three groups, and they mostly overlap. So.
Interesting. Yeah, maybe all three of us would be in that little section. But yeah, I will just say at the events, not everyone raises their hand for everything. It's more like, it's a mixture. Definitely some people don't identify.
And you're different things on different days, I think, too.
Yeah.
At least I am. You know, some days I'm... Yeah. So you have a flow chart. I want to move forward because we have some important things to talk about. you have a flow chart for navigating our climate predicament, and it's not a simple document. It's looks more like a spaghetti bowl than the usual geometric flow chart. It has choices and turning points, including just giving up. Give us an example of several of the key decisions to make the flow that at various points in the flow chart and where those decisions carry us.
Sure, yeah. And just to note, anyone who wants to get eyes on this flow chart, it's quite a piece of, you know, quite a visual. And you can see it on the website, bettercatastrophe.com. It's there. You can actually download it, print it out yourself, etc. Yeah, and it folds out of the book. So if you get a book, then you get the flowchart too. But yeah, one question here is, you know, there's many key decision nodes in it, but one is, you know, can we fix it? You know, and then it goes, well, that depends, and that depends, and it basically, you know, kind of goes off of what are we in the crisis of? Are we in the crisis just of carbon? Right? Is it just transitioning from one kind of fuel source to another, or are we in a more civilizational-wide crisis where, you know, the notion that we can have infinite growth on a finite planet, you know, challenges our whole notion of progress and our whole notion of, you know, nature is something that we, is an externality that we can just dump our stuff, you know, our bad stuff into and just extract and turn into goods. So there's, you know, that's a sort of, that's an interesting question, right? So in a very narrow way, if it's just a question of moving from carbon to solar or something, then it's a, just a purely engineering problem, and we can go on as we have been and just swap out one fuel for another. And, you know, so it allows people to explore those questions. You know, I obviously think it's much more than just a simple engineering problem, but that gets us into a big, important distinction in the book and in the flowchart, which is, are we having a problem, or are we in a predicament? You know? And a problem is, like, solvable in a fairly straightforward, linear, agreed-upon way. And a predicament is something that we are in and we can't actually solve. We can respond, we can make it, you know, not so bad, or we can, you know, keep it at bay, but we can't, like, solve it in a kind of simple way that, like, makes it go away. And so that's an interesting thing to explore in the flowchart, too. Are we having a problem, or are we in a predicament? And again, if you read the book, you'll see that, you know, and the people I speak with are all fairly aligned that we are in a predicament, and that requires a more complex and spiritual and multi-headed kind of response. And so then another, I think, another question that comes is, like, so, you know, if we actually think that it's too late, or it's, you know, it's the end of the world, however we define it, well, I'll just say there's another thing is, like, people throw around this term, it's the end of the world, and in a very loose way, it means different things to different people, and there's usually not a lot of definition of that. And so there's a distinction in the flowchart between, is it the end of the world, or only the world we know? So there's the flowchart helps us make that distinction, sort of untangle that. And then it was like, oh, if you think it's the end of the world, so then there's the question, so why bother? And it offers various reasons why you might bother. One is, well, I have kids, right? You know, out of moral integrity, you bother. Regardless of what you think the chances are, you do it out of moral integrity. You know, I must do what's right because it's right. So that's to quote a well-known eco-philosopher named Kathleen Dean Moore. She's basically channeling Immanuel Kant, you know, one of the key foundation stones of Western philosophy there. Or, like, why bother a legacy? And then it asks the question, well, because of what kind of ancestor do you want to be? And you have two choices, a dick or not a dick, you know? Anyway, so there's some humor in the chart. And then one of the most important questions, I can end here if you'd like, is what will it take? You know, what will it take to try to turn this around? Or what will it take to make for a better as opposed to a worse catastrophe? And there's a lot of things, like fewer showers, like, you know, as people say. And then there's a little note there, I'm not sure you appreciate the scale of the problem here. You know, fewer showers or better stories, you know, as we've been talking about, better stories to tell about our civilization, to tell about, you know, the amount of agency we have here. Serious technology, yes. Powering down, you know, reducing are the footprint of our civilization, yes. Community resilience, yep, we're past certain points where the communities now need to be able to resiliently adapt to the unfolding climate impacts that are coming. Yes, grassroots resistance, yes, blocking pipelines, protecting forests, you know, indigenous lands, etc. Stronger policy, absolutely. You know, social revolution, some would strongly argue that. Yes, all of these. And then it sort of says, how about all of these? And you're like, yeah, we need everything and everyone. So that's what will it take, everything and everyone. And then there's a little caveat there, which is, well, not everything, because there's a whole lot of fake solutions out there. So there's a filter in the flowchart is, like, is it a real solution, you know, or is it just more greenwashing BS, you know, and then it's like goes on to, all right, maybe it's a real solution, great, but is it a just and democratic solution, you know, or is it just the same old inequality and exploitation just now powered by renewables instead of fossil fuels? So it's like, oh no, that's just and democratic. So there's like a filtering system for the kinds of solutions that will not only help us switch our energy sources, but actually, you know, build a better society as we do that. So those are really critical. And there's more to that. And I love to end with this. There's my most favorite quote comes from in the whole flowchart is towards the end. And it comes from Robin Wall Kimmerer, someone who probably hasn't been on the show, but that many of your listeners I know and love, indigenous botanist, wrote Braiding Sweetgrass, et cetera, and has been celebrated very deservedly so. And she says in the flowchart, there's a quote from lots of people, but says, even, you know, why that she approaches, even if things are going to unravel, she's going to approach the good, the bad outcomes with gratitude. She's going to approach even the worst of situations with gratitude. And here's why. She says why. Even a wounded world holds us, giving us moments of wonder and joy. I choose joy over despair, because joy is what the earth gives me daily, and I must return the gift. And that's Robin Wall Kimmerer, and a real touchstone for me, a very beautiful sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Really, really beautiful, yeah.
I also want to mention at the close of the book, you have some roles that people can take on if they're ready to move forward in one way or another. People like the warrior, the sunrise movement folks, engineers, preppers who get prepared, the policy ninja like Richard Heinberg who keeps fighting for better policy, the rebel, the artist. And I think listeners and readers will find those extremely helpful. They help you go from being a pessimist or a limited optimist and say, ah, here are some ways one could go. And that includes Timekeeper on the climate clock, which is down 6 minutes and 9 seconds since we started this program.
Yeah, it's time for the Gallows Humor Jokes.
Ah, yes.
Because we're almost out of time here. So could you tell us some jokes and I love the idea which you said earlier on the show and is in the book, an act of cosmic defiance. I love that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's what I think one of the things Gallows humor does offers us. As a friend of mine says, without gallows humor, all we have are gallows. So there's a gallows joke, or even a meta gallows humor joke for you right there.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite humorous perspectives on all this is, you know, a lot of people are fighting over whether climate change is real or not. And I think you guys were mentioning early in the show, you know, that in some ways it's sort of moot if we just want, you know, clean, you know, we don't necessarily have to agree on all that just to agree that we like clean air, you know. So there's this great moment in the book in a cartoon where there's a big climate summit gathering, and the person's listing in a slide show all the things we can get from making this transition, and there's a guy in the back, you know, railing, going, well, what if it's a big hoax, you know, and we create a better world for nothing? that's an oldie but a goodie.
Yes, it is.
You know, that just sort of puts everything in sort of hilarious perspective. But I would say one of the ways that I end a lot of my book events is with a chant. You know, like a kind of a classic protest rally activist chant, but with very different kind of words. And I'll share that with you, because that's a very interesting form of gallows humor. So it's like, you know, classic setup of like, what do we want? And it's like, a better catastrophe. You know, when do we want it? As late in the century as possible. there's some humorous moments for you.
That's great. Thank you, Andrew Boyd, for being with us today. He's the author of
Absolutely.
I Want a Better Catastrophe. It's I'll read the whole thing again. Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor, published by New Society. It's an existential manual for tragic optimists, can-do pessimists, and compassionate doomers. It's a very powerful book. It's influenced, and we've been talking about it all week as we prepared for this interview. We really appreciate your great work and what you've done. Listeners, go out and get a copy of that book.
And thank go to bettercatastrophe.com.
Okay.
Yeah, bettercatastrophe.com. Yep. You can look, read samples of the book before you decide to purchase.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen and Susan, thank you so much. It's been an honor to be on the show. I love the title, Ecotopia. Let's have more of that.
Yeah.
And let's have a lot of Ecotopia with our inevitable slice of dystopia. All right? Let's have a better catastrophe, all right?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We opened the program with the catastrophic part of Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain. After the storm passes, you get some fairly peaceful music and calm music, and we hope that may be one of the outcomes of our discussion about gallows humor and wanting a better catastrophe. Stay tuned. North State Local Voices will be coming up in just a couple of minutes. We always appreciate your listening to Ecotopia. Send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com or go to our website where this program, this recording, if you'd like to listen to it again, will be up. That's ecotopiakzfr.com. Thank you for listening.
North State Give and Take is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Northern Star Mills, serving the North Valley with farm, garden, and pet supplies since 1898. Northern Star Mills offers natural and organic soil amendments and fertilizers as well.